Hello and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. I've got morning voice, Tim.
I see that.
Some guys get morning wood, I get morning voice. This goes deeper and more raspy and weird.
I see.
Which is good for true crime, because today we're mixing genres, Tim. I'm excited about this.
Oh, good.
You know, when you have those moments that you hear a new story, you hear something that makes you go, because you're not familiar with it?
We cover
a lot of true crime on the show because it's, you know, True Crime Tuesday, and covering cooking wouldn't make any sense.
No.
But every now and again, a story is so bizarre that I've got to dig a little deeper. Well, Tim, we're going to start off talking real quickly about one of our favorite subjects, Bigfoot, Tim.
Okay.
Dave, this isn't Darkness Radio. This isn't Beyond the Darkness, Dave. This is True Crime Tuesday. Why are we talking Bigfoot? Well, Tim, just hold on a second and I'll explain it to you. I don't know why you got to jump down my throat when I'm in the middle of trying to open up the show. Jesus, give me a little time here.
Didn't really say anything, but...
Yeah, that spoke volumes to my heart, Tim.
Okay.
You might be surprised to learn that Bigfoot has been spotted at 13 eerie locations in Alaska, Tim. That's this article that I found.
Really?
You read through it, and they're small. I'll share them with you. Number one, Peterson. There are stories told from 1900 to 25 about a trapper that went into the woods and disappeared shortly after reporting exceptionally large tracks in the snow. The strangest story ever told was a book by Virginia Culp, and it documents this incredibly eerie encounter in further detail. Well, that's kind of an ominous story, right? Almost has a true crime element to it, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what we're here to talk about, Tim.
Hmm.
Sounds like a good one, though.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
How about Ruby? Ruby, Alaska, Tim. 1943, it was reported that a man was attacked by an unknown creature in the wilderness about 18 miles down the Yukon from the town of Ruby. He later died of internal injuries, and the creature that attacked him, presumably Bigfoot, was said to be run off by his dog team, Tim. Or was it? That sounds like a pretty damn good True Crime Tuesday, doesn't it?
Could be, yeah.
It's not that one, not Tim. Oh. No. We're still in Alaska, though, because this is where all of these take place. How about in Bristol Bay, 1940, near the town of Kalaluka?
Bless you. Yeah.
Thank you. A group of ladies was berry picking, as they're known to do, Tim, when they reportedly came upon a large man-like creature. This sounds like a Dear Penthouse letter to me, doesn't it?
A little bit, yeah.
Long hair flowing and running down his back. They later went on to capture this creature, cage it, and feed it. Hmm. These ladies are crazy. Later died, and the story was documented in a letter from the cage keeper. That sounds naughty. I don't think that's a True Crime Tuesday. That's like a Bestiality Tuesday, and we don't do that here, Tim.
No.
How about Wrangell Narrows? In 1942, a man was sitting on the beach when he reportedly saw a massive 7-foot-tall creature that was hairy and rummaging through the woods. That's not really a crime, but it's another Bigfoot sighting in Alaska, Tim.
Yeah.
Fort Yukon reports the year was 1969, Tim, when a man reported shooting an abundantly large, hairy, man-like creature that was not human while he was out moose hunting. But that's still not our story, Tim.
I've taken a few slugs moose hunting. I'm not gonna.
Yeah. Gotta be. Well, you're a big hairy creature roaming in the woods. Yeah. Told you to wear that flare orange, Tim. Yeah. Can't keep walking around nude. Galena, Alaska. In the 1960s, there were multiple sightings of a huge Bigfoot-type creature rummaging in the woods near the tiny village. The creature was quick on his feet each time and didn't allow himself to be seen for too much time. Ooh, we have kind of a peeping Tom Bigfoot, Tim.
Hmm.
Interesting, but not our kind of show.
Yeah.
Huslia.
Again, bless you.
Huslia, Alaska. 1970, many people in the village reported seeing an ominous creature passing swiftly through the night. That's it. That's a very short story. Hey, Bob, I seen an ominous creature strolling our streets. I don't know why my Alaskan guy sounds like he's from Texas, Tim, but that's...
It's South Alaska, Dave. That's why.
How about Ketchikan?
Ketchikan?
Ketchikan, Alaska, Tim. The southeast town holds some pretty wild tales of the past. As a matter of fact, in 1956, about 50 miles southwest of Ketchikan, a man that was out fishing reported seeing an 8-foot-tall creature that was around 400 pounds and walked on 2 feet like an ape. There was also a young boy that reported a similar sighting nearby in 1960 and reacted to the encounter, believe it or not, Tim, by screaming and running off as fast as possible. The only crime there is this young man was not going to reach manhood anytime soon, reacting like that, Tim.
Yeah, yeah. Not big with the ladies, yeah.
Nalato sounds like a refreshing, delicious snack, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, frozen.
Put a little Nalato on your toast with some peanut butter. In 1920, a local man died in the area after unsuccessfully trying to fight off a massive creature that he described as standing on 2 feet and being human-like. Ooh, that's another one that's got that kind of the weird twist of possible true crime, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
Should we stop there and dig a little deeper?
Well, let's dig deeper, sure.
We can't actually because I don't have a guest for that story.
Oh.
But it's good.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
How about in Kobuk River, Tim? The year was 1966, only a year off from the birth of a very popular True Crime Tuesday radio host, Tim.
I was born near Dull Creek.
No, you were many years later. Yeah, I was referring to my son.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The year was 1966, the year before the birth of our Lord and Savior Dave Schrader of True Crime Tuesday, Tim. When a man near Dull Creek found large man-like tracks near his mining camp, one day he approached the creature and shot it. Rude, I think, Tim. How about just offer it some Nutella? Afterward, he described it as being a large, huge, man-like bear that was enormous in size and walked on 2 feet. A lot of people are shooting and actually hitting Sasquatch in Alaska, Tim.
Well, if you get close enough, Dave, you shouldn't miss.
Nelchina Plateau.
Yeah.
In the 1930s, locals were shocked when a Bigfoot creature killed one of the locals by tearing him to shreds. They later described the creature as a cannibal giant. I think we have a winner, winner, chicken dinner. How about you, Tim?
I think so.
That's not it either.
Hmm.
But it was close. So close. Wrangell, Tim, multiple Bigfoot sightings in the area during the 1900s. One includes a man that was berry picking in the woods and was awakened by the sounds of a massive man-like creature having a conversation nearby. Another story in this area is about a tall Bigfoot creature that actually ended up carrying a 3-year-old back to her home after she wandered off into the woods without anyone noticing her. So that's kind of a feel-good story, Tim. Not much of a true crime there. So what could we possibly talk about that has Bigfoot and true crime elements? Is that your question, Tim? Is that what you wanted to know?
Eventually, I was going to get around to that, yeah.
How about if we go to Port Chatham, also known as Portlock, this eerie small village on the Kenai Peninsula, was home to so many Bigfoot sightings that the entire population eventually fled due to an overwhelming fear. For a period of time during the 1900s, Tim, torn up bodies were washing up on the shores of this small village, making people believe that it had to be the evil Sasquatch spirits that roamed the woods nearby.
Mm.
Does that sound promising?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Good, Tim, because that's it. That's our story. We're finally there.
Oh, good.
And how did I hear about this story? How did I get introduced to this tale? Well, it's a funny thing, Tim. This weekend, I spent up at the Palmer House Hotel with a few friends from Texas, Tim.
Oh.
Who wanted to come in and take a look at the Palmer, have some margaritas, and play Cards Against Humanity with me.
Oh, good.
And as we did, one of them leaned across the table and he said, "Have you heard this story?" And I said, "No, but we'll be sharing it on Tuesday." And he agreed to join us. Greg Lawson is our guest, paranormal explorer, international lecturer, and author. He is the paranormal detective, Tim. Greg has traveled over 40 countries, visiting some of the Earth's strangest sites, conducting his own investigation of their paranormal histories. Greg is a 26-year law enforcement officer, professional investigator, police academy instructor, college educator, and former expert witness for investigative procedures. He also researches and investigates human paranormal experience in locations known for spiritual or unusual activity. He's also authored two books on the subject and specializes in providing alternative perspectives to explain human experience. He also has a 10-year military veteran career with the U.S. Army, Navy, and Air Force, and is currently a Lake Patrol and Underwater Recovery Team Sergeant in Central Texas. This guy is the actual modern-day Indiana Jones, Tim. He's strapping. He's handsome, he is skilled, and has the ability to go everywhere and do everything. And unlike you and I, who like to sit secure in our homes and talk about these stories, Tim, This guy's boots on the ground. When he heard, Bigfoot murders, he didn't read about it and talk with online friends while Cheeto dust collected on a shirt like you and I, Tim. He went there, and now he's here to tell us a story. Greg Lawson, welcome back to True Crime Tuesday.
Thank you so much.
Buddy.
Yeah.
This is a wonky story. And as I started doing a little digging and I caught that article, that little blurb, I was excited to see it wasn't just you pulling my leg, that there was actual information out there about this case. And first of all, let's get started with, how did you hear about this? I mean, this seems like, unless you live in that area, it's not something that would really be well known.
Well, I kind of was living in that area. I was stationed at Fort Richardson, just outside of Anchorage. And when I was sent to Alaska, I didn't want to go to Alaska when I was in the Army. They just kind of sent me there. And so once I got up there, what I tried to do is make the best of it. And, I've always been interested in paranormal stuff. I've always been interested in ghost stories and monster stories and that sort of thing. So I spent a little bit of time doing some research at the Historical Society down in Anchorage. Kind of a nerdy thing to do, but I needed to do my research before I go out and go hiking. A lot of my friends would go hiking just randomly, go to a park and hike. But I was looking for ghost towns, abandoned mines and stuff like that. And Portlock, Port Chatham, and there's a chromite mine there. There's an old sawmill there. There's an old cannery there. And it was supported by a small village. And I thought, wow, if I could ever go down there, I could check that out. And then I ran across an article in the Anchorage newspaper in the early 1970s talking about these murders. And that's why the town became a ghost town. So had to go there, Dave. Had to do it.
Well, you read this story, and I mean, you like all facets of the strange and unusual. And certainly we're investigating ghosts this weekend. You've been on Midnight in the Desert and Beyond the Darkness and Darkness Radio with us talking UFOs and other different topics. When you start reading that there are murders taking place, people believe, and not just crazy drunken town people, but an entire town leaves and the law enforcement is on board with this. I got to ask, I mean, what was your initial thoughts as you're perusing these articles and history?
At first, I just figured it was, there was a problem with the cannery and they shut it down or relocated it or something of that nature. And I was pretty amazed to find out that it basically was a consensus of the whole town. They had had enough murders. They had lost enough people to where the indigenous population there was like, no more of this. And most of them migrated a little bit north to the Homer area and just completely left the town. It's very hard to find any of the actual any law enforcement reports out of this because the town basically had about 50 people there plus all the cannery people that work there and the sawmill people that would come in and out. So just depending on what time of the year, on how large the town was, because it's obviously in Alaska and it freezes up in that area. So, you know, certain parts of the year, everybody kind of migrates on out of there, except for the actual, you know, indigenous folks that live there. They're Russian Aleut descent. In that area, you have quite a few, Native Americans that live in that area of the Aleut and the Inuit people. And then the Russians, when the Russians came in the 1700s, they interbred with them. So there's a lot of those folks that still live in that area, but just not in Portlock.
And this time frame, when are we talking? When was this the active area?
So it seems to be that the active area was about the time that the cannery started up there. So that would have been in the early 1900s, right about 1900, actually. And there's some stories of the original people that were kind of coming in that area. And there was a prospector that was treed by a hairy man. The Native Americans up there call them Nantinooks, which is just a bushman or a tornit, just a large, hairy, bipedal type creature.
They think of it as, I know there are some Native American tribes that refer to the Bigfoot as just another type of tribe that is human. Do they look upon this as a beast, as a creature, or just as another walking upright human creature?
No, they look at it as a beast or a creature kind of thing, but one that's very smart, one that fits right into the Sasquatch Bigfoot idea. So you read stories about them being like evil spirits, these big hairy things, and that is not it at all. They believe that they're just as real as you or I or a bear. They're just a different type of creature. And originally they believed or they reported that they lived in small villages. There's these oral histories that are passed down of these hairy men living in the same area, but they didn't have the same technology as the Eskimos or the Inuit or the Aleut people. And there's one story of a younger hairy man stealing one of their canoes. And he ended up being killed by one of these Native Americans. And that kind of drove their village away, the small group of hairy men then fled that area because of the violence from the humans, not from, you know, the violence from the Bushmen. So, you know, there's a lot of those oral stories, oral histories that get kind of twisted around a little bit. But you look at the consistencies, and that's kind of it appears that, you know, they were living side by side the way, I guess, cave people, whenever we descended whenever we evolved, we still lived in proximity of other type species. So that's kind of the way that the story seems to go.
All right. That's bizarre, especially to have that many encounters where people are seeing something, interacting with them. In some instances, a lot of these articles ended with the Bigfoot creatures being killed. That's got to be intriguing to you, because if that's the case, there should be remains somewhere.
Yeah, and you hear a lot of those. When you say a lot, you know, a 10 or more is a lot. To think that they actually killed one of these and didn't bring it back, didn't freeze it, didn't skin it, didn't stuff it, didn't do something with it, especially as strange as it would be. When I went down there, so I was at the Morrell Welfare and Recreation Center in Seward, trying to figure out how I could get down to Portlock, and I ended up talking to Coast Guardmen that were assigned a fishing boat to take out all of the service members that would come down for their MWR, you know, their break. And so it was during the week, and these guys didn't have anything to do, and I was there during the week, and they're usually busy on the weekend, and I went down and I told them the story. And these guys were probably, they were my age, maybe a year or two older. And, you know, I saw their eyes light up, and sure enough, you know, they take these fishing trips out for 10 to 12 hours. And it was a good time. So I talked them into taking me all the way over there. It was just a little over 100 miles from where we were. So
were they new to this story as well, or had they heard it? Was it kind of local legend?
Oh, no, they had no idea. They were part of the Coast Guard, and they got assigned, you know, temporary duty assignment to do this particular thing for their Morale Welfare and Recreation Center. And so they, you know, I don't even know where they were from or anything, but yeah, they weren't locals. And when I told them the story, you know, I mean, you know, you're 19, 20, 21 year old guy, and you hear a Bigfoot story with murder, and, you know, you have access to a really nice big fishing boat, and nothing to do. So let's burn some gas. And that's what we did. I took him down there. We beached real close to where what I think was where the cannery was. There's still a lot of pilings and stuff. It looks like maybe that's where the cannery was. And we spent about 3 hours just kind of walking around trying to figure out how the town was laid out. And I was looking for the cemetery. I found what I thought was a cemetery, but there were no headstones or anything like that. But it looked like to me that it was someplace where multiple people had been buried. But you know, the weird thing about that is it's a ghost town. There are some buildings still there that completely, you know, fallen in. There's a cabin, kind of over, further away from the cluster of debris that was the town, that it's still standing. It didn't have any doors or anything on it, when I was there. I don't know whether it's still standing or not, but, it looked like there was a sawmill, 'cause there's all these logs that are cut to one side that are just laying in a big pile. And then the pylons and the footings and everything for the cabins that would have been there and that were all had all dilapidated. And so, yeah, it was the weirdest part about it is, you know, you can imagine it's Alaska. It's on the side of a big hill, what would be considered a mountain in Texas. You know, there's these big, tall pine trees, and under the pine trees, the undergrowth is like a jungle. I mean, it's the really big broad-leafed plants down there. And while I was there, it was just creepy, man. And I've hiked all over the place in Alaska, and I've never really been creeped out. I was creeped out by this place.
Now, creeped out, did you feel as though you were being watched? And I know you like to look at the psychology of an event. Do you believe that there really was something about that area, or was it just the concept of the story that you had heard and read?
No, I think there's something to do with that area. There is something weird going on there. I don't think anybody could get off a boat or get off a plane. There's only two ways you can get there, and both of them are going to be by water, either a float plane or a boat. There might be some trails or something from other towns that lead in there. Maybe you can get in by, I don't know, a four wheeler or something. I doubt it. It's pretty far away. But anyway, I don't think there would be anybody that would go into that area and walk around, at least the way it was that day. There was no sound. You get in those woods and the sound of the ocean, the sound of the wind, the sound of everything, it just stops. You know, and in Alaska, Alaska's state bird is the mosquito, right? And so I was there.
No, that is Minnesota, and we'll fight for that right.
Well, it's pretty damn bad up there. And, you know, because when you have breakup, everything melts off, man. You got three months or so of, you know, these mosquitoes are really busy. They need to feed, they need to breed, and then they're going to be, you know, hibernating again. So they're really active. And man, there was nothing. There was no movement, no insect movement. It was just creepy. And so to answer your question, yeah, man, I felt like I was being watched. I really did. And you know, to know that these particular things happen there. I mean, over the most active time was right around World War II, and the chromite mine, the mine right across, I think it's called the Queen's Mine. It was active because they needed this chromite for the war effort. So there was a lot of people down there, you know, mining there. I actually went to that mine. It's kind of small. The entrance is kind of small. I went in a little way and I was by myself and I just went, yeah, I'm not going any further. And I turned around and you know, went back across. But there was all this activity. And to know that during that time, there were multiple guys that were up there hunting. They would go hunting doll sheep. They'd go hunting moose or bear, whatever. And they'd just disappear. A few weeks. Now, a month.
Let me ask you about that. Yeah. Because you work in law enforcement. You do diving for a lot of people that go out on boats or swimming and that just vanish. Right. It's not that unusual, right? And no. I don't mean it in kind of a dismissive way. But for people that wander off into the woods, there are wild animals that can strike very fast, sometimes being stalked by mountain lions and other creatures, or happening upon a bear and her cubs. That war is over pretty quick and may leave nothing of you to be left to be found. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. It's very prevalent. It's that anybody who's going out in Alaska in the wintertime, in the snow, in the mountains, hunting for sheep or bear or moose or whatever they're hunting for, to go missing. I mean, there's a million different things that can happen to you that that could kill you. And so when you tell me, you know, over a 10-year period that you have, eight missing people, that's not that big of a deal when you think about the conditions. You also have to think about, who are these hunters? You know, were these hunters coming over to work at the chromite mine? And while they were there, they went, hey, you know, while I'm up here, I'm going to go hunting. And they don't know anything about the area. They don't know anything about the threats and how scary it is to be stuck in a blizzard up there or a whiteout. So those things can happen. The weird thing about it was, when they would find their bodies later, you know, we don't taste that good. Human beings apparently don't taste that good.
Oh, nice way to throw in apparently after you first said we don't taste good. I like it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really surprised that there would be pieces left. But, you know, you got to think about how cold it is. What's going to last in a refrigerator at 34 degrees? How long is it going to last? And so you start finding arms and legs and missing, you know, torsos and missing heads and that sort of stuff in the streams or lagoons that are coming off of the melt off of the mountain. That gets a little bit weirder, especially if you take a look at, you know, the actual injuries to that, you know, what was it? And I can't speculate what they were finding, because I can't find anything that has any real documentation to it. I have a friend of mine that is a state trooper up in Alaska, and I have one that's a retired state trooper, and they're working on it now, trying to figure out, you know, where would any kind of official reports have gone, you know, in the 1920s to the 1950s? Where would these reports have accumulated, and who would have been, you know, responsible for the bodies? The big one, you know, you had mentioned the attack up on Yuki Island, the Yukon River. Now that's way up central Alaska. It's way up further than what we're talking about. We're talking really southern Alaska. So There's another article in the Homer Tribune only a few years ago by a Melania Keel, I think. And she was interviewed by the Homer Tribune, and she talked about her godfather, Andrew Kamluck. And he was a logger in that area. And obviously, you know, that the evidence is there for that town, because I saw where the sawmill would have been and a lot of the machinery that's all rusted that they left behind. It looks like it was already the broken machinery. They probably took everything that they could use. In Alaska, you know, you build a house someplace and you're going to leave. Well, you're probably going to take your house with you. You know, you're probably going to disassemble it. So some of those were disassembled and taken out of there. But Andrew's death was very interesting because he was by himself and his skull was crushed in. And there was a piece of logging equipment. And that's something that I'm trying to narrow down before I speculate or go off of what everybody else is saying. I don't know what this piece of logging equipment was, but it was something that would have been very heavy and, you know, a normal person wouldn't have been able to pick it up and hit somebody over the head with it. So it's just very, very strange. His whole death, which I would consider a homicide, possible murder, for the simple fact that, you know, there's no other evidence other than blood on this big piece of logging equipment that was found quite a ways away from the body. So anyway, I'm working on that side of it. And like you said before, I kind of like the psychology. Whenever I do an investigation, I look for the holes that other people have missed. So I try to fill those holes with whatever the information is. And it's typically, you know, some really good, solid documentation, research type stuff. So that's what I'm working on that.
So how many total murders took place, and from around what year to what year do we know of in this area?
Well, so the first attack was reported right around 1900, and that was the prospector that was treed by one of these hairy creatures. And from that, you look at the Yukon River incidents. You mentioned both of them, and Albert Petka and I can't remember what the other, John Meyer, I think his name was, but they were up in the Yukon area. Both of those guys were attacked by something hairy. And you got to think about this, man. These guys knew what a freaking bear was, right? They're not getting something confused.
Right.
Yeah. These are experienced guys that are, you know, prospectors and, you know, they know what a bear is. And to go back and say, I was attacked by something that wasn't a bear. You know, it was tall, stood on all, you know, its back legs, stood up like a man. You know, in both of those cases, I believe both of those cases, the guy's dogs ran them off because, you know, these guys all had sled dogs. And so the dogs ran them off. And you got to look at it also, you know, the time of year. You're not going to have a lot of bear activity in the snow. The bear are going to be primarily hibernating during that time. And, you know, I guess there could be some sort of rabid bear or something that comes out. You watch the movie The Revenant. I don't think there's ever been a better, you know, version of a bear attack than in that movie. And you can imagine what that would be like. So these guys, you know, basically said it's not a bear. It was something else. And there's nothing else up in Alaska that would match that description other than a Bushman or a Bigfoot type creature.
What was law enforcement doing about this? I mean, and what type of law enforcement was there at this point?
So there wouldn't have been any law enforcement down there. This was a cannery town. And so that's, I've read as much as I can on this. The interesting thing is nobody has gone to the Alaskan Historical Society. The Historical Society has a historic canneries initiative. And what that is they're collecting all of the information from these companies that started these canneries. I mean, anybody with a good bit of money could just go out there and build a big building and get some cannery equipment and start catching salmon. I mean, they describe the salmon runs around Portlock and Port Chatham as you could walk across the river on the backs of these. There were so many fish trying to go up river to spawn.
That would start to leave you back down the realm of bear.
Sure. There's
I'm curious what your thoughts are on, I mean, certainly this has become more prevalent in society now that we've seen photographs of them, but bear with mange could look quite terrifying. They don't look like bear.
Oh, yeah.
And if they're still losing patches of hair, it could look more unusual and bizarre. I mean, you're right. I know what a bear looks like. But if I was in the woods and saw one of these things that have mange, I might not. And I know what a bear looks like, and I'm an indoor city dweller. If I saw this thing out there with mange, I might mistake it for something completely different. If the salmon is so thick, that also means that it would be heavily populated with bear and other creatures that would be feasting off of that.
So when I was there, you're exactly right. When I was there, there are bear trails everywhere. I mean, I'm not talking about here's a couple of footprints. No, they're everywhere. Here's the difference. A bear doesn't have an 18-inch long foot pad. And that's something that they were seeing up there, were these really large foot pad prints up in that area, which of course led them further down the trail of a Bushman or Sasquatch, Bigfoot. And all of those, you know, the description that you had as far as, let's say, a bear with mange. Now that would not identify the hairy men that we're talking about, because if he had mange, you wouldn't have any hair. But let's say you do have a bear that has mange. He's going to look weird. He's going to look like a giant chupacabra, right? And here's something interesting. There's a video online that you can probably find on YouTube that there's this bear just walking around in the neighborhood on his back feet. He's standing up, and he's just walking around. He walks
over. Hey, boo-boo. Let's find us a picnic basket.
It is hilarious. I'm sitting there looking at this guy going, wow, look at this thing. And then you see him. He's going between two houses and he's cruising along. And then he goes down on all fours. And when he does it, he clutches one of his paws up to his chest because it's injured. So he hops around a couple of times, like a normal bear, except he's on three legs. He's got his other leg pulled up. And then he stands up again and he takes off walking. So, you know, there was a reason that he was walking on all fours, and he was walking on all fours all the way through the neighborhood, is because one of his forepaws was injured. So that kind of makes sense. So, you know, you can throw in all these what ifs or possibilities that they are saying, well, it's not a bear. It didn't act like a bear. It didn't behave like a bear.
Now, I've seen some of the uniforms and outfits that would be worn up there at that time, and a lot of them were these people that would wear pelts of animals. And if you have no law enforcement going on, it's kind of an unregulated Wild West town, it sounds like, during this era.
Yeah.
You get a lot of guys drinking. They're bored. They're lonely. They're drinking. When these bodies are washing up, how much damage is done to them? And again, could it have been something as much as a knife fight took place? The body was left there and then bears forage and find the body, or other creatures come along and start digging at it. So it gives this perception, or were they finding them very similarly torn apart with no rhyme or reason?
There's not a lot of good documentation on that. I don't know. I do know that, you know, in the wintertime in Alaska, you get cabin fever. People get pissed off. Like you said, there's a lot of drinking Native Americans. There could be, I mean, this is a prime time for a serial killer to go in. You don't have any law enforcement, and, you know, or, you know, get even with your neighbor for some dispute or whatever, it would be very, very easy. And you throw them out there, and there's going to be animals, birds, eagles, all those types of scavengers that would go over and eat a lot of the body. So there's going to be, post-mortem injuries to the body, and it's going to be really hard to try to figure this out.
Well, then, in your estimation, I mean, obviously there's this many sightings. There are this many people that believe that they've come upon something. As you said, they would know the difference between a bear and the hairy man. There's obviously something different about this. Do you think that this collection of activities is among the most intriguing proof that something like Bigfoot does exist? Or yeah. Do you think there might have been a cover up of a serial killer and them trying to keep it quiet at that time?
So, contemporary science and psychology and all that, we can outline a perfect, formula for this was nothing more than a series of accidents of people who went out hunting that were out of their element and just, wanted some adventure and died. And then maybe one or two died of a normal fight with a neighbor or somebody else. And then one guy was killed by a bear. And, without having all of the information, and that would be, a description of the bodies, at least a drawing of some sort. I mean, everywhere you had some sort of a doctor that would do some sort of post-mortem, examination of the body. I mean, this is the 1940s. So there, I mean, that started many, many decades before that, where doctors would, examine the body. So that's the thing that I'm looking for. That's what I'm trying to find, where this information would have gone, who would have been responsible for recording the deaths, and where did these bodies go? And all of that's going to have some records someplace. And that's like I said, I'm starting off with the canneries initiative, just to find out what company actually owned the cannery there. Where would their records be? Who's managing their records? Did they just go away? Did they just throw away everything? Or, does a historical society actually have some of this stuff? So what is the more likely scenario? A Bigfoot came and killed these people, or, they were accidents, squabbles, a naturally occurring attack? Well, most likely it would be the normal things that just happen over a 10-year period. But that does not eliminate, good eyewitness information of somebody who's been attacked and says it wasn't a bear, it was something else. And people that lived in that area and know that they have a history of bushmen or hairy men that roamed in that area. And then you have people that actually see them and report seeing them. So I just don't want to take anything off the table on this. That's one of those things, when you're doing a homicide investigation, there's a saying in homicide that there's no such thing as a coincidence. So when you have multiple people kind of telling the same story, it leads you to believe that there's something to it. Now, could it have been something else? There's all kinds of ideas and legends up in Alaska. And like you said, you have somebody who's pretty big to begin with. So let's say they're 6 foot. And then you put a big hairy robe on them, and then you put a big, some sort of head protection on top of that, that makes you 7 foot tall, makes you look like you weigh 200 pounds more than what you actually weigh. And your boots that you're going to be wearing are not going to, like, I have size 12 feet. Well, then that means that my feet are going to be size 15 or 20 once I wrap them all in whatever skins that are protecting my feet. Now I'm walking around in the snow. All this evidence would lead to normal people saying, okay, this is probably a misunderstanding. Yet, the story is still there. And it makes, to me, it makes complete sense that there could be the possibility that we have hairy, man-like creatures still out there.
Was there anything from what you were able to uncover that showed any type of pattern? It happened at certain days, certain times, certain parts of the month. You know, anything that might look on the outset that there, you know, is a hunting cycle.
No. And like I said, I am trying my best to find some actual documentation. Most of the stuff, like you would not consider a article in the Alaska, you know, newspaper or the Anchorage newspaper from 1973 as a direct piece of evidence. That's just a piece that someone did to interview, you know, a person that had a story about Portlock. So you can't look at that as an actual piece of evidence. And the other stories are all hearsay. You know, it's somebody who met somebody who told them this story about something that their father did. You know, so we're three people removed from the actual actual incident. So that's why it's so important, you know, that the paranormal detective, well, okay, I'll get the story, but let's go and try to find the real, you know, testimonial evidence from the first person that actually, you know, experienced the thing. And that's where some of these, you know, come up. And the Albert Petka up on the Yukon River, you know, and those are some of the ones that, you know, you got to look at and go, this guy knew what a bear was. This wasn't a bear. Maybe it was a human being dressed in pelts that came and attacked him because he was in his sacred area, or he was trying to take his gold claim from him, or, you know, any other amount of reasons. I believe that nature tells us, history tells us that there is the possibility that there is a hairy bipedal type creature running around out there that's trying to do everything they can to stay away from us.
All right. Now, with that said, you are in the thick of it all over the world. In that area, what would the odds be that somebody living off the grid, could live out there and remain undetected for their entire life?
Their entire life, I don't know about that, but I know that there are people that do that. I had a friend of mine, his name's Jeff Hall. He's a retired state trooper from Alaska. He ended up tracking down a guy that was a serial killer, a spree murderer. His name was Michael Allen Silka. And Michael Allen Silka killed a series of people. I think he killed like 8 or 9 people in a series of events. And his whole deal was he wanted to go out in the woods and live off the grid. And while he was doing this, he was just killing people and taking their stuff. And that's how he ended up getting up into the interior of Alaska. And that friend of mine, Jeff Hall, he ended up shooting this guy from Jeff Hall was in a helicopter and shot him from the helicopter and killed him. So there are people that look at Alaska, look at the Yukon area and go, that's where I'm going. I'm going to go out there. I'm going to live off the grid. But it's a lot harder than people think.
But again, kind of going into it as an investigator, how easy could somebody go off the grid and live up there without notice? If they're not murdering people, they're just living a normal kind of hidden life. Could it be pretty accessible because of the remote nature of that area?
So you would have to come in every year and get certain supplies. You would have to have some sort of, you know, citrus type thing so you don't get scurvy. There's a lot of the guys that went up in the Yukon during the gold rush and got scurvy. So John London, famous writer. He ended up getting scurvy by going up there and not having the proper vegetables or fruit or whatever. So you're going to have people are going to have to come out and go
but
someplace.
You could come in. You could go into town probably unnoticed in that area just doing something. It could be a traveler. It could be this where they don't really even pay attention, especially if you're coming into town only a couple times a year. You wouldn't necessarily stand out.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you would?
Yeah. Oh, in Alaska. Oh, yeah.
Now, the reason I'm asking this is then looking at something like Bigfoot, could a creature actually exist in a remote area like that without detection, without the being able to be tracked? I mean, obviously it was being detected. Many people saw it and were coming into contact with it. But I'm trying to get a concept, especially in, you know, the Pacific Northwest, Minnesota, Wisconsin, the heartland of America. Could something like a Bigfoot truly exist in these areas, paranormal detective Greg Lawson, and not be detected more regularly or have been shot, killed, and found by now?
Well, that and that's the sad part about it is we're losing habitat like crazy, man. We are spreading out and just crunching all these animals into, you know, further and further away out of their habitat. And so in the continental United States, in CONUS, if you look, you're not going to find a road anywhere in the United States that's more than 21 miles apart. And I think it might have even been cut down since I read that, and that was probably 15 years ago. So if you choose a good direction, you just continue walking, you're going to run into a man-made road within 21 miles. And some of those areas are like in Nevada and everything. Everywhere else, I mean, roads are so close to one another. Just keep walking in one direction. You'll end up getting to a road. So in the continental United States, man, it would be very hard. There's areas in the up in the mountains. There's wooded areas in Arkansas that I'm sure that, you know, it's months or years that a human being hasn't walked across that area. So if you're a motivated, intelligent being and you want to stay hidden, there's a certain pattern of a behavior that you're going to have to develop, which obviously, you know, Sasquatch has developed this because he's really good at it. And, you know, you would have to, you know, every few minutes you'd have to stop and listen. Cause I can hear somebody coming in the woods 300, 400 yards away from me, or at least I used to be able to. Now my hearing isn't as good cause of rock and roll, but you know, when I was in the Army, I sat there, I could hear somebody walking through the woods. I could hear a deer walking through the woods. And, you know, if Bigfoot isn't listening to rock and roll, then his ears should be pretty good. And if he's staying healthy, he should be able to hear anything coming up on him. So I think that there is a possibility, definitely in Alaska. I could lose you up in Alaska. My problem would be not getting scurvy. I would have to come in and, you know, buy beans because, you know, the growing season, you're looking at a 2 or 3 month long growing season. So if you're out in the woods and you're trying to stay hidden, you don't have a greenhouse, you don't have, you know, solar panels, you don't have any of that stuff. You're going to have to get certain, you know, vegetables and, right. and fruits. So you're going to have to go into town.
These deaths that took place then, in your estimation, probably unrelated. And I know I'm talking to the logical police military side of you right now. Probably unrelated, just time of the tide there. Or do you believe that there really is a chance that something like a Bigfoot was, in fact, responsible for mauling and murdering up to 8 people?
I think there's a chance that there could have been a Bigfoot in that area. It's fairly rare across the board as far as Bigfoot attacks. They don't seem to be a violent type species. And me as a detective, I would look at this straight as, you know, death by misadventure, accident, possible murder, homicide. And that's the way that I would go because I know I can collect evidence for that. to immediately say, oh, it's Bigfoot. Bigfoot's come in here and killed. No, I'm not going to look at it that way. When you're trying to solve a homicide, you don't try to prove who the murderer is. You put the case together and everything should fall into place, you know, and you see detectives, and I've worked with cops before. It's like, yeah, I know who did it. It was that dude. I know it. He said he didn't do it, but I could tell in his eyes because his eyes are too close together and his forehead's too big. And he's, you know, whatever this intuition that this cop has, I just know that he killed him. Well, how about we don't look at it that way? How about we just set that information aside and actually work the case and prove what it's not? When I work a drowning, somebody says, hey, you know, we were out swimming and my buddy drowned, and we go out there. Okay, I don't go out there to prove the drowning. I go out there to investigate the death, and whatever comes out of that comes out of it. And that's one of the big mistakes that people have as far as preconception of going into an investigation, is automatically assuming one particular thing. But you always investigate the normal before you go to the paranormal.
Let me ask you something, Greg. In all honesty, now, let's ruin many people's weekend activities. My kids love to go to this local lake and go swimming. I won't step foot in the lake, because all I see after doing 9-10 years of True Crime Tuesday is a burial ground. In any given time, in bodies of water like lakes and things that people are probably swimming and boating in regularly, how many bodies do you think are really in there?
More than what they've been reported drowned, that's for sure, because you're going to have body dumps in the lake. That's a great place to get rid of a body. You know, you're going to kill somebody and then take them to the lake and dump them in the lake. So you're going to have unknown corpses down there. And then you're going to have known corpses that they couldn't find. People saw drown and then they couldn't find. And then you have the normal drownings. In the lake that I work on, we average anywhere from, well, our average is actually going down. It's actually becoming a lot safer. I'm not sure why yet. We're trying to figure it out. But it's very deep lake, and we have on average about 13 drownings a year. Well, over a 10-year period, that's 130 people. Over a 20-year period, you know, that's 260 people. Most of them get recovered. Where I work, we have 11 for sure that we know are in the water and we just couldn't find them.
That that's something you should remind your children when they're taking mouthfuls of water and spitting them at one another in the lake. Just think about those things, yeah, and the fish that you're eating from that lake. Now, I don't want to ruin everybody's summer festivities, but that's that, you know, it's weird. Do you find that doing the work you do does affect the way you look at a lot of things now that many people would look at as beautiful, you know, and fun, exciting, relaxing places? Do you just look at them as, oh, man, I just know there's bodies here?
Well, yeah, and it's kind of strange because of the areas that we actually are still actively looking for some missing people. Every day there are party boats out there. There's 100, 200, 300 people just swimming around right where somebody drowned. And we know that the body is still there. It's someplace close to where they were last seen, because in the area that I'm in, there's not enough water flow to get them out of that area. And there's certain things that happen. So when you're looking at that sort of thing, it can get pretty creepy.
Do you think that there are many serial killers that will go undetected because they're using lakes as dumping points?
That would be a really smart way to do it. I would think for some serial killers that would definitely be an option. It's going to be the harder location to find somebody, and you're going to have a lot of biological activity that will minimize any evidence on the body. So it's very difficult when you're having to deal with any kind of aquatic death investigation.
That's pretty terrifying in itself. Getting the chance to go boots on the ground and be in that area in Alaska where these stories took place and see, breathe, walk in these areas yourself. And, you know, again, also going through the research of the detailed information and maybe lack of information that was out there, it paints a pretty compelling and bizarre story. Like you said, does Bigfoot exist? And maybe he's taking the blame for this because it's easier. But Greg, an entire village just left because these violent acts were taking place and there was no explanation for it and no law enforcement for it.
Well, you know how these stories go, right? So if you look up Portlock or you look up Port Chatham on the internet, you're going to find a lot of these hearsay stories about what it is. And you'll find the two newspaper articles that, once again, is just a story that's being retold. And you know that newspaper reporters change stories from time to time, you know, to make them a little bit more interesting. The big key thing for me is I want to identify who owned the cannery, what company it was, and why did they leave? You know, is it because it was Portlock's just so far out of the way and they had a, you know, this is in the end of the 1940s, early 1950s. Did they then were the ships that processed the fish more efficient because they can move around, they can store the fish, they can process the fish, they can transport the fish. And that's where a lot of these canneries actually went away, was when they started building these big, you know, fish processing ships. And it's a lot more efficient that way. So is that why the cannery left, or is it truly people were just fed up with, you know, people dying and they got scared, went, you know what, it is not worth the amount of money they're paying me here to stay here and possibly get killed by Bigfoot. I'm out of here. And then the whole town fled. They had the post office closed down in 1950. So I know that the Postal Service will have, you know, a historical account of why they closed the post office. That'll be something interesting to look at. But those are going to be kind of the only thing. And who had police jurisdiction over that area? And if anybody died in that area, you know, who had jurisdiction to pronounce the body and issue a death certificate? So, you know, that is definitely there. They're going to have death certificates issued of people out of there. So that's another thing that I need to go. I'm really thinking about just going ahead and taking a week-long trip up there and do a bunch of open records requests and see what I can come up with.
Very cool. Well, please, as you find more and more about this, and especially if it keeps taking twists down the bizarre trail, come back and let us know what you uncover. Would you do that?
I sure will.
Fantastic. All right, guys, that's it. The Sasquatch slaughters. What do you think? I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, folks. Email us, dave@darknessradio.com. You hear what happened. You hear of all of these accounts. I mean, I read 12, 13 accounts of Bigfoot sightings, and some that ended violently and bad for people, some that people escaped from. This entire town up and folds up because they believe there's a Bigfoot and it's hunting people. What do you think? Email me, dave@darknessradio.com, and we'll share it in an upcoming episode. I'd just love to see what your thoughts are. You know what, Greg, this is one of those that it sounds real easy that, you know, it's as I was playing the skeptic through most of this episode with you, to think that there could be other things. But as you said, there are so many credible accounts of Bigfoot sightings there. And again, I guess that then draws the line of what do we consider credible? Right.
Right. Right.
And why do we believe just because this man saw it? But this was before the popularity of Bigfoot sightings in the 60s. Right. This wasn't something that was part of pop culture. This is probably something that would be more embarrassing to people to admit at that time than anything, because they wouldn't want to feel frightened or mocked for seeing some imaginary creature.
Right. Yeah. And my whole thing is I've heard scientists say things like, well, there's no other life in the universe. It's just us. We're the only ones. Well, just off of math, that's wrong. I mean, there's just, how can there not be as much stuff as they're finding every day, new stuff. So in a microcosm back here on Earth, that's where I go with, I can't prove there's not a Bigfoot. You know, it could be some other creature that we don't know about. But I'm not going to say that there's not, because there's just too many people saying they see these things. And we trick ourselves. We're very bad at gathering information as humans. We really are.
Right.
And it gets really twisted up sometimes, especially if you're under any kind of stress, your uptake in your brain doesn't work quite right. And so, you know, but what if?
Very cool.
Gigantopithecus.
Well, hey, stop calling me names. I got feelings, man. Greg Lawson, it's always great catching up with you. We've got links up for Greg's website. You can find his two books there. Always a fantastic visit. You're welcome to stay for Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals if you'd like, Greg, but we need to examine some really bizarre cases now.
I would love to stay.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's kick open the case files. We've got them, and one starts right here in Minnesota on Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals.
It's Crayon News Storytime.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
All right. Tim?
Yes.
You like to pick on Florida, man.
Oh, yeah.
You like to point the fingers at other places where there are dumb people. But today's first story starts right here in the great state of Minnesota, Tim.
Find it hard to believe.
You were just here, Greg.
Yes, I was.
You were just here, and you missed this guy. A Sturgeon Lake man is facing felony charges after incidents that took place in July. Richard Joseph Zuck, age 41, is being charged with first-degree burglary, second-degree burglary, terroristic threats, and drug possession. It's going to be a hard rap to beat, I'm going to be honest with you. According to the complaint, the Pine County Sheriff's Office received a call at around 2:45 a.m. reporting that Zuck was knocking on the door and ringing the doorbell of a Sturgeon Lake residence. The caller said they suspected the man had been drinking and had left in a Ford Fusion. The Ford was identified as belonging to Zuck, and a deputy began responding to the defendant's address. On his way to the location, the deputy saw the car heading towards him, and the driver stopped next to the deputy's car and agreed to speak with him. During this time, dispatch received another call regarding the defendant entering yet another nearby residence without permission. According to the second caller, Zuck entered her home, walked into her bedroom, and asked her if she wanted to have sex. Fair question. He's asking permission. He knows the rules, Tim. That's a good start.
Yes, it is.
When she said no, he asked, well, how much would it take to have sex with your daughter?
Whoa.
Turns out he had also snuck into the daughter's room before entering the mother's room. Yeah. Talk about creepy. Upon Zuck exiting his vehicle, the deputy noticed a small plastic bag containing a white substance, which later NIK tested for positive for methamphetamine. He was read his rights and proceeded to tell the deputy that he had been to Sandstone earlier in the day to buy a drug nicknamed Ice, and admitted to going to the two houses to see if they just, you know, wanted to hang out, according to Zuck. Zuck told the deputy he turns into a sex robot when he uses Ice. You know that problem, Greg, right?
Every time you're on Ice,
you are just a sex robot.
It is crazy.
And that it was drugs that influenced him to go into the house. Investigators later determined two reports were made to the Moose Lake Police Department on July 13th of a defendant approaching an adult female and a 14-year-old female also for sex. Zuck is facing 20 years in prison and or a $35,000 fine for the felony charge of first-degree burglary, 10 years and or a $20,000 fine for the second-degree burglary charge, and 5 years and or a $10,000 fine for terroristic threats and drug possession charges. I didn't read anything in there that was threat. I mean, he was asking and then just, you know, tried to throw a couple bucks out on the table. And I don't mean to lighten this mode at all, but I mean, that's kind of a weird story. Where was the terroristic threats in that? Was it just in being in the house and kind of demanding sex, Greg?
I think that's probably what it was.
That'll get you.
I think. Yeah. So the quote unquote terroristic thing is just, you know, to create apprehensions, you know, fear. So, yeah, if you got a guy walking in your house and asking you questions, that can kind of fit in there.
I think the word sex robot is enough of a threat on its own. Yeah.
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 Police are reporting that people are overdosing on a meth alternative made from wasp spray. People can't get any dumber, Greg, they start making drugs out of wasp spray. We're going to go to Boone County, West Virginia. Police in West Virginia are warning people about an alarming drug trend. We're seeing this here on the streets in Boone County. That's what Sergeant Charles Shutpin told WCHS. People are making a synthetic type methamphetamine out of wasp spray. Authorities believe at least three people overdosed last week because they used insect repellent to make a meth alternative. In my opinion, drugs are bad around here. It's available to people, and then all of the time they're trying new things that we wouldn't even think about. That's what resident Diana Ferguson said. Stores in Boone County reported selling 30 cans of the bug spray last Friday alone. Sutton said the effects of using it are erratic behavior, extreme swelling, and redness of the hands and feet. From what we're being told, if you use it, you know, you might use it once or twice and be fine, but the third time when your body hits that allergic reaction, it can kill you. That's what Sutphin said. It's a cheap fix and don't know what the overall result of their usage of this is going to be. Authorities are working with poison control to determine the best treatment for someone using wasp spray as a drug. How about just let them go away? That might be the best possible treatment. Good God. How high are you that you think, you know what? Wasp spray. That might be the answer here.
Yeah. That takes me back to 1970s, 1980s. You know, they used to sell LSD, or what they said was LSD, but all they were doing was getting pieces of paper and spraying them with bug spray, and the strychnine or whatever the chemical is in there actually has signs and symptoms of hallucinations and that sort of thing. So yeah, instead of making your LSD in your laboratory, you can just spray some stuff on a paper.
We don't want you to do that, folks.
Of course not.
No, that's a bad plan.
Yeah.
Since we're on the meth wagon right here, Tim.
Yep.
I should let you know I found your meth. That you had lost and hidden somewhere and couldn't remember where.
Yeah, I've been looking all over for it.
Yeah, Louisiana woman allegedly caught with meth hidden inside her vagina said she didn't know where the drugs came from. So my guess was it had to be the meth you lost, Tim, because I know you're fond of the old prison pocket.
I am, yeah. It's a good hiding place, yeah.
Ashley Beth Rowland, 23, was accused of July 31st of stealing $5,000 from an apartment of a man she'd been staying with for about a week, according to the documents published by the Ouachita Parish Sheriff's Office. The man told the West Monroe Police Department that while he was showering, Rowland swiped his cash and left, allegedly confessed to police she didn't take the man's money and left his apartment. The documents said a female correctional officer later searched Roland, and inside of Roland's vagina discovered $6,233 along with a clear plastic bag of roughly 1 gram of meth, which Roland denied was hers. Hey, Greg, Officer Lawson, the money is mine. The meth, I don't know where that came from. Would you buy that story the first time around? I mean, could you be lenient and understanding?
No.
No?
No.
Hmm.
Sorry.
Roland, Tim, important to know, don't stuff meth up your ass and then tell Greg that it's not yours. He won't believe you.
No. Nope.
Nice. Roland was arrested and charged with theft and narcotics possession. Online records from the sheriff's office state as of Tuesday she remained behind bars in lieu of just an $8,000 bond, Tim. She's available. $8,000. What is that? Oh, you only got to come up with like $800 to get her out, isn't it?
Well, she's got what? Six and a quarter already up the old cooch. So, I mean,
they take that from you, Tim. Believe it or not, you're not allowed to keep.
It's only
the roll of fivers in your cooch while you're in jail.
It's only $1,800 to get my girl free, and then by gosh, I can get the rest of my pot, coke, and all the other stuff she's got up there out.
God, I wonder if that's where my TV remote is, Tim. I've been looking for it.
Oh, maybe. I think my PlayStation controller's up there too. So
my PowerPoint clicker's missing.
Mm. That could be there too. Yeah, I'll look for you, Greg.
We'll have to shake her down and see what we can find. Now, here's a problem. I got to talk about addiction for a few minutes. Whereas we're making light of other people's addictions. I understand this next story, Greg, probably more than I should. A former patient was arrested after deputies said he stole an ambulance from a psychiatric hospital in North Harris County and then used it to go get KFC. That crack cocaine chicken, man, that's there's something. They should bust the colonel, dig him up and bust him, because whatever is in it is addictive.
There is something in it.
The Harris County Sheriff's Office said it was called around 2:30 a.m. Thursday about a man who stole an ambulance from a hospital on Cali Drive. Deputies say the ambulance was left running outside the hospital, problem number one. Authorities told ABC 13 that 56-year-old Carlton Andrews got in and drove off, driving to KFC and then off to some other places so he could eat, get some cigarettes, and stopped at a gas station to fill up the vehicle, at least. When asked why he had the ambulance, Andrews told deputies, "I needed a ride." He eventually gave up and was arrested at the gas station. He's going to be charged with unauthorized use of a motor vehicle. So they were going easy on him, right? Because it's not theft. They're just getting him for unauthorized use of a motor vehicle.
Yeah, that's kind of how they have it set up. And, you know, you got to be you got to give it to him. He was honest. He just needed a ride. And
right. And he, well, hey, somebody left a car. God provides. Do you think that's what you're saying?
Something like that.
Now, this next story reminds me of the ingenuity of Tim in college. And I want to know if you would pull somebody over for this. All right. Put yourself back in the beat days, Greg, when you're driving around the streets, pulling people over for speeding, maybe littering, maybe mooning, not wearing their seatbelts. This honestly reminds me of a Tim move from college. We're going to go to Colorado, where a Colorado driver came up with a quick fix for his broken taillight. He used a red Gatorade bottle and taped it to the spot while he was on his way to get it fixed. From a distance, it might look like a taillight, but if you get close up on it, you can see the details of the do-it-yourself project. Police said they appreciate the effort, but encourage drivers not to do this. In a statement, officials with the Longmont Police Department said that working taillights can prevent accidents and save lives. If your taillights are broken, please just get them repaired. Don't tape Gatorade to the back of your car. The man did receive a ticket.
Wow.
That's
a warning, man. You don't give him a ticket for that. That's friggin' awesome.
You would just give a warning?
Oh, yeah. I might. Yeah. Would you
take a photograph and post it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
What do you think of, as a matter of fact, what do you think of police officers using Facebook now as ways to capture, you know, at least a couple times a month, we have police stories coming in off of their Facebook pages.
Yeah, there was one we read recently about they were trying to get a guy to come in on a warrant, and he responded on the Facebook page, and they gave him an extra day or two because he had asked for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're on the lookout, and he's like, "Hey, guys, I've been super busy. I just have a few things to wrap up, and I promise I'll be in by Wednesday."
Mm-hmm.
And he showed up on Wednesday, and they were cool with it. But there's a lot of these cases now that people are, they're mocking, they're taking photographs and posting them to the police, showing where they're at. You guys are so stupid. You're never going to find me. And there's the Costco behind them in town. So I do love that aspect. But do you see social media as an important element to crime busting now?
It is a key element to crime busting. Your phone and social media. Yep.
All right, guys, we both had jobs. All three of us have had jobs we hated and felt might not appreciate us, right?
Oh, yes.
This one right now.
You could vanish and nobody would even know or give a damn. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Here's just a headline for this story. The mystery of what happened to an Iowa man a decade ago has finally and tragically been solved. Larry Eli Murillo Moncada's body was discovered at a local supermarket wedged behind a refrigerator 10 years after he went missing and 3 years after the store closed.
Oh,
I got to look that one up.
Why are you questioning me?
No, that's just fantastic.
The mystery of what happened to the Iowa man a decade ago has been solved. They discovered him wedged behind a fridge. Back in January, 10 years after he went missing, 3 years after the store closed, on Monday, the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, along with the Iowa State Medical Examiner's Office and Council Bluffs Police Department, announced that the body found earlier this year at the old No Frills supermarket, boy, they live up to their name, was identified as Murillo Moncada. Sergeant Brandon Danielson with the CBPD confirms to People magazine. Sergeant Danielson said that Murillo Moncada, who was 25 years old at the time of his disappearance, was employed at the Council Bluffs supermarket before he went missing. Murillo Moncada was first reported missing by his parents on July 28, 2009, after they said he became upset and ran out of their home. At the time, the parents claimed their son was acting irrationally, perhaps due to the medication he was taking. That's what CNN is reporting. Speaking to the Des Moines Register, Sergeant Danielson recalled how weather conditions were extremely poor that day, and Murillo Moncada fled his home without anything in his possession. It was a snowstorm at the time he left. He left no shoes, no socks, no keys, no car. He said, adding that Murillo Moncada was not scheduled to work at the time he arrived at the supermarket. Management at No Frills told the outlet that employees often entered and exited the store despite not being scheduled for a shift. In mid-January of the year, as workers were contracting firm, were moving shelves and coolers in the empty building, they found the body. At the time, the building had been closed for 3 years, so it was incredibly difficult to determine any details about the corpse, as it had been there for so long. So my guess is he's hiding back there, must have gotten electrocuted, and then just was wedged back there and never found. But how could that smell? Greg, you've smelled decomposing body. How could that have been mistaken for anything else?
I've been in some supermarkets before where the meat department smells pretty bad. So yeah, if it's near some sort of refrigeration equipment, it would slow down the decomp process. If there's depending on the ventilation, but that's bizarre because people stink bad, man.
Yeah, they do.
I'm sure for about 20 days, somebody was going, man, what does that smell?
Dave, seriously, you may think this is a rip or a rib, but have you lived in Iowa? I mean, seriously. I mean, you in the spring and summertime and even into the fall, you constantly have farm smells. So
Iowa, just send your emails directly to timhatesiowa @gmail.com.
So you've always constantly got manure smells or farm smells or, yeah, I mean, or
dead guy smells
and honestly, and on top of that, and I'm just telling you because I've worked radio in Iowa, people got chores, people got animals to feed and they don't really... They're not really looking out for you all that much. So, if he was caught behind a refrigerator for a bunch of years, they probably weren't really concerned all that much about him. They got lives to live.
Here's a little update. They say after leaving his home, Sergeant Danielson said that authorities believe the man went to the No Frills supermarket and climbed on top of the coolers where he accidentally fell into the 18-inch gap between the cooler and the wall and became trapped. The situation seems plausible, as former employees told authorities that it was common for workers to be in the storage space on top of the coolers, according to the Register.
What is this place?
It's no longer in business, but it was the No Frills Market. So the, you know, the employees would just hang out on top of the coolers.
That makes complete sense, right?
They said the major gap and hidden location were likely why Murillo Mankata was never found. That's about a 12-foot fall, Sergeant Danielson told the Register. The noise of the freezer units could also have made it difficult to hear any cries for help. It's so loud, there's probably no way anyone heard them. See, I would guess, I've been, you know, behind refrigerating units. It's hot behind the refrigerating units. How did that not speed up the decomposition?
Yeah, maybe it did. I don't know. You know, the smell happens after a couple of days, and then, you know, just depending on how quickly the body dries out, because it's going to bloat up and, you know, do all that happy stuff. And so you're going to have 20, maybe 30 days of off-gassing. And I don't know, man.
That's my everyday life, off-gassing. Oh, good grief. All right, Utah is our next place to stop. Utah boy was selling ice-cold beer, and he gets the police's attention. This little fine young-looking fella standing on the corner, he's holding a big white sign that says ice cold beer in big bold black lettering. That's kind of ballsy for a kid to be out selling beer. Well, a boy in Utah had a marketing strategy so good people called the cops on him. The boy is seen holding a sign posted by the Brigham City Police Department with a sign that says ice cold beer. But if you pay close attention, in small letters above the word beer, it says root. This young man in the area of the 600 South 200 East block has a twist on a lemonade stand. Yep, he's selling beer, root beer, that is. His marketing strategy has resulted in several calls to the BCPD, but apparently it's paid off as business has been good. That's what they say about this.
I'd buy one.
Would you call the cops on a kid outside selling if he was holding up a sign saying ice cold beer?
You'd be surprised. You know, there's a kid here in Minneapolis who... There were neighbors in the neighborhood that were calling the cops on him because he had a hot dog stand and it was successful, and he was trying to save up money to bring his family to, I think it was like Disney or something like that, and they thought he was in violation of a health code, so they called the cops on him and they wanted him shut down. Well, it turns out that Steve Harvey had him on a show and bought him the proper accoutrement, for lack of a better term, and got him like the stand and everything so he would be up to code. And the cops even helped fund him and got him set up with the with the city so that he would be up to code so he could make the money.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So
it's like there was another story recently of a lemonade stand where some jackass homeowners called the cops on this kid for not having proper license. And the whole police force showed up and took pictures of themselves buying lemonade and posting it on social media.
Right.
As kind of a big finger to the people that are out there. Greg, as a cop, would you ever enforce that law on a kid who's selling lemonade on the corner?
Nope.
Or do you have to? I guess maybe that's the real question.
If my boss tells me I have to, we try our best to enforce laws to the level of community standard. People say, well, you can't ignore laws. Well, yeah, cops ignore laws every day. I would never make it home if I didn't ignore the way you people drive out there.
He's looking at you, Tim.
So I have to, you know, people are like, oh, you have to enforce. You're sworn to enforce law. Well, yeah, I am. But, you know, they're.
Let the kids sell lemonade.
Yeah. I mean, as soon as somebody gets E. coli or something, we got to do something. But
all right. Our last two stories. We're going to Bradenton, Florida. The authorities say a 55-year-old Florida man pulled a gun on a late arriving furniture delivery team, saying he shot people for less. Oh, my God. I've been there. Have you ever been waiting for the stupid cable company to show up?
Every day.
Man, I want to put him in the well and lower the bucket of lotion down to him. Manatee County Sheriff's investigators say Mitchell Helton is charged with two counts of aggravated assault. He was arrested August 3rd after the delivery team called the sheriff's office. Would you enforce that one? They were late, Greg. Would you enforce it?
You know, you need to be on time. Yeah. If you're going to run a business, you need to be on time. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
At least send a, you know, send a postcard or something.
Thank you.
You know, ahead. And hey, wow, I'm going to be a little late. It ran long.
A Palm Harbor, Florida man was arrested after threatening to stab and shoot employees at a pet store. Apparently that's frowned upon. He had gone in trying to purchase some dog food using an online mobile app. However, employees told him they no longer accept that type of payment. He then went home and called customer service and said that he's going to come back and shoot the place up and stab people. And he would have done it if his girlfriend hadn't been there telling him not to. That's terrifying.
Yeah. I'm surprised it doesn't happen more often. We got some nuts out there.
Yeah, it's crazy. You wonder how these shoot-ups happen at Walmart and such. You've got a lot of knuckleheads out there. Talk about just dumb crimes, stupid criminals. Blaine says, I was just joking. That's all. I was joking.
Nope.
Come on, guys. Can't you take a joke when I tell you I want to come in and shoot everybody and stab you? You know that one. It's an old tried-and-true joke. Everybody loves it.
Yeah. You missed the wink.
Yeah, I guess.
You didn't see the wink?
And here's, I guess I have one more story, and I blame this on Billy Ray Cyrus and Nas X because of that stupid take my horse to the old
hotel town road, or
whatever. Yeah. Man on horseback burglarized a Newport Richey home in Florida. A man who goes by the name Rooster rode a horse to break into a Newport Richey home, according to the Pasco County Sheriff's Office. Lonnie Maddox, 52, and Angel, a brown horse, were seen on security camera wandering around the property Thursday morning. Maddox opened a screen porch and tried to get in. The padlocked front door then gave up and entered through a back window. According to deputies, the window broke and caused about $100 worth of damage. Angel, meanwhile, wandered away. He had no times for the shenanigans and did not want to be a part of it. His getaway course or his getaway horse took off.
Yeah, Seabass wasn't with him?
No. Rooster and Seabass not together, no. Court record show he is, believe it or not, a long criminal record and has been found guilty of car theft, drug possession, domestic battery, among other charges. So another fine, upstanding citizen of Florida. At least he's got some flair and panache.
Yeah.
Right? To come in riding on a horse to hold you up.
Yeah. If you're going to do it, may as well, you know.
Yeah. If you're going to do it right. Well, that's it for this week. Greg Lawson, paranormal detective, thank you for joining us and sharing the strange Sasquatch slaughter stories with us. We appreciate it. And thanks for hanging in for some dumb crimes, stupid criminals. Do you have any important words of wisdom to impart on people considering a life of crime?
Don't do it.
Amazing. Tim, why don't we have more guys like this?
It just makes you nervous. You know, you're going to be nervous for the rest of your life wondering, you know, are they coming for me?
Yeah. That's it for this week. We'll be back again next week with more of the best in true crime talk radio. I'm Dave. That's Tim. That's Greg. This is True Crime Tuesday.